Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories of the past week in science. Our lead story today concerns, well, was Chicken Little right? Is the sky falling? The media had a lot of hoopla around the recent Chinese satellite that plunged into the atmosphere, and people were calculating the odds that one day it might land on someone's backyard. But the question is, how dangerous are these space probes anyway when they come barreling down back to Earth? And why do they fail anyway? In outer space, we have a perfect vacuum, right? Most people believe. Therefore, our satellites should stay up there forever. And why couldn't they predict? With all our machinery, with all our computers, why couldn't we predict exactly when and where the satellite would hit the planet Earth? So we'll say a few things about these things and also about the past. Did you know that we've had nuclear reactors that came down from outer space, spewing large amounts of radiation on the Earth's surface? And also, what about the space station? This $10 billion space station, will it eventually have to be deorbited? Around 2028, will it too become a gigantic meteor from outer space? What a waste. And then we'll say a few things about TESS, the Transiting Extrasolar Survey Satellite, the latest space probe launched by NASA, and hopefully it'll find the holy grail of planetary astronomy. That is, a twin, a doppelganger of the planet Earth in outer space. And if TESS finds it, will it create an existential shock, realizing that when you look at the night sky, you can point in one direction and say, right there we have a twin of the Earth in outer space. And of course, people also want to know, well, does anyone live on these planets? And if so, can they visit us? Well, recently, some people think we had a close encounter with a UFO that buzzed not one, but two airplanes. Two seasoned pilots from American Airlines and Phoenix Air swore that there was something flying overhead. And the question is, what was it? We can rule out most of the usual suspects, but after everything is said and done, what could possibly have signaled to two seasoned pilots that there was something floating overhead? Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The media, of course, had a field day talking about this gigantic Chinese satellite that came tumbling down from outer space last weekend. And the question is, well, how dangerous was it anyway, and why did it have to fall? Well, first of all, the Chinese space program is very methodical, and they copy all the basic steps of the Russian and the American program. Not very original. Stage one was when they sent Chinese astronauts, or they call them taikonauts, into outer space. Stage two is when they start to do maneuvers like docking with satellites and doing maneuvers in outer space. The next phase is to create a space station, just like our $10 billion space station, which is currently orbiting the Earth. The Chinese want to have their own space station, and that's where this came from. This was the first of a series of modules to be sent into outer space to create a space station. And then following the United States and Russia, the next step beyond that is to go to the moon. That's right, the Chinese have a plan to put their flag on the moon. Now, the exact time this all happened keeps changing. They used to say it would be 2025. Now they're saying perhaps 2036. But they're going to follow the footsteps of the United States and the Russians. So this satellite that came tumbling down, it weighed 18,000 pounds. It was the size of a city bus. It was chock full of scientific equipment. And actually, on two occasions, Chinese taikonauts actually visited the space station and did some docking maneuvers. So then the question is, well, how dangerous was it when that satellite came blazing down from outer space? The media made it sound as if it's going to land on someone's backyard. Well, in principle, yeah, but the probability of any such thing happening from outer space is less than 1 in a trillion. You're more likely to be hit by lightning bolts from outer space than an artificial satellite put into outer space. So we're talking about the fact that most of the surface of the Earth is water. And so satellites, in some sense, come down from outer space all the time, maybe not as big as this one, but for the most part, they land in the ocean or they burn up in the atmosphere. In fact, it's projected that about a third, perhaps less than a third, of the spacecraft actually survived re-entry to land on, well, maybe somebody's backyard. In fact, in the history of the space program, in the 50-odd year of the space program, only one person was ever recorded as having been hit by a piece of artificial space debris, and he lived to tell about it. Well, the next question is, why did it fail to begin with? I mean, outer space, isn't it a perfect vacuum? So shouldn't that satellite have stayed up in orbit forever? Well, the answer is no, because what goes up must come down, said Isaac Newton. And even satellites way out there are not floating in a perfect vacuum. There's a little bit of atoms, mainly hydrogen gas out there, and that causes friction. No matter how small, there is friction in outer space. And this means that eventually all, I repeat that, all of our satellites, unless they reach escape velocity, all of our satellites will eventually come down. Now think about that. There are thousands and thousands of pieces of debris that scientists have sent into outer space, and every single one will fall back to Earth. This means that some of these satellites will come down in a matter of years, decades, centuries, maybe even millennia, because some of their orbits take them way outside most of the atmosphere of the Earth. However, they do all experience some friction, unless, of course, they've broken free of the Earth's gravity entirely. So it means that eventually every single piece of debris out there, thousands of them, will eventually come back and burn up in the atmosphere of the Earth or actually make landfall. And then the next question is, how come scientists couldn't predict exactly when and where this satellite would land? With all our computers, you would expect we would know exactly where it's going to fall and when. But no, there are several reasons why we couldn't predict that accurately. First of all, many of these satellites have lost their propulsion system and they're tumbling. And as a consequence, their orbit is much more complicated when they hit the atmosphere because they're tumbling. Second of all, the atmosphere way out there is not perfectly spherical. It expands and contracts with the hours of the day, and therefore it's very hard to predict exactly when and where impact will take place. And last, it's like skimming stones. You know, if you take a rock and you throw it over the surface of a pond, it will skim. And where will it land? Well, it's very hard to predict. It depends on the number of times it skims over the surface of the water. Well, the same thing happens when our satellites gradually decay in orbit, gradually hit the atmosphere of the Earth, and they start to skim as well. And so for all these reasons, it is very difficult to accurately predict precisely when and where a satellite will hit the planet Earth. And then, even though this one was relatively harmless, what about the past? It turns out that in the past, we've had incidences much more serious than the one this past weekend. Perhaps the most serious one was Cosmos 954. In 1978, the Soviets lost control of that satellite, which was a nuclear reactor. I repeat, this was no ordinary satellite. It was a nuclear reactor that plunged back into the planet Earth. In fact, people were taking bets as to exactly where this reactor would land on the planet Earth, because it was highly radioactive. This was no ordinary satellite. Well, what happened was it burned up, as expected, and it sailed over the northern territories of Canada. And it spewed out high levels of radiation over a long stretch, several hundred miles long. Well, the CIA saw this as a splendid opportunity to capture some secret Soviet hardware. So even the CIA sent Husky teams out into the tundra to salvage as much as they could of the wreckage of a nuclear reactor that plunged into the Earth. As expected, parts of the path were quite radioactive, and people had to be very careful. And yeah, the CIA actually did retrieve some of the equipment, but I doubt they got much usable information because, of course, the satellite disintegrated in that whole process. And so it means, of course, that we have to be very careful when we send radioactive materials into outer space, because if there's a misfire, it means that high levels of radiation could really land on someone's backyard. And around the same time in the late 1970s, Skylab came down. That was an American satellite that was about 10 times bigger than the Chinese satellite which came plunging down. Now, what's the lesson for the future? The lesson for the future is we have to be very careful because we have a space station. The International Space Station is about 50 times bigger than the Chinese satellite that burned up, and it cost upwards of $100 billion. Let me repeat, $100 billion to assemble the space station and more money to simply maintain the space station, and we are running out of money. Many of the nations of the world said, okay, we've done it. We've lost interest. We want to go to Mars. We don't need a space station. So, some people say, let us deorbit the space station. Now, it turns out that funding is more or less guaranteed to 2028. After that, it depends on if the sugar daddy comes along to want to keep it going. The president has said that he wants private enterprise to take over. He doesn't want to be in the business of financing a space station. And of course, a space station doesn't get headlines anymore, but a trip to Mars certainly would get a lot of scientific and journalistic attention. And so, in other words, after 2028, the space station might be deorbited. Now, of course, it won't be a tumbling spacecraft. We'll have some control over the rockets of the space station, and to the best of our ability, we'll try to make sure that it lands in the Pacific or the Atlantic Oceans. But there's no guarantee for all the reasons we laid out before. So in other words, we're going to see this happen again and again and again. And a big one, the space station, the largest machine of science ever sent into space, could come down after 2028. And this takes us into our next topic of discussion, and that is UFOs. Recently, it was announced that the Pentagon had a top-secret study of UFOs, spent over $20 million analyzing them, and it shocked some people that the Pentagon would do this. However, for me, it's not surprising at all, because if the Pentagon did not have such a secret study, it would be derelict in its duty to protect the homeland. Now we have a new incident that took place just a few days ago. It took place in Arizona. It turns out that not one, but two seasoned pilots saw something fly overhead. The first pilot was from Phoenix Air. The second one was from American Air. These two pilots have thousands of hours of airtime between them. So in other words, we're not talking about amateurs. We're talking about seasoned professionals. The first airplane said he saw something over his airplane. And he radioed in to the control tower, hey, there seems to be something above me. And then the second plane also radioed the same thing. Apparently, this object was traveling at about 50,000 miles above the surface of the Earth, or about 10 miles above the surface of the Earth, while normally airplanes never get that high. Commercial airplanes don't fly 50,000 feet. They cruise at about 35,000 feet. And so what could it be? Well, some people said maybe it's a commercial craft or a military craft. But then the FAA checked records, and they found out no military, no civilian aircraft are in that area hovering over these two commercial airlines. And there are no balloons reported in the area. So what could it be? One by one, they crossed out all possibilities, leaving another possibility, and that is aliens from outer space. Well, first of all, let me say that a lot of people email me with sightings of UFOs. I'd say about 90-95% of them can be pretty much easily dismissed. They could be meteors streaking across the night sky. They could be atmospheric anomalies that sometimes look very much like a flying saucer. Then we also have the possibility of the planet Venus. Yes, the planet Venus is the brightest object in the night sky next to the moon. And when you travel in a car and look back at it, it follows you. It follows you. And children often say, gee, mom, dad, the moon is following me. Well, Venus also follows you because of something called parallax. And that's the reason why many people think that Venus is a UFO. So anyway, the military and the FAA ruled out most of the usual candidates. And therefore, what about the last 5%? Well, the last 5-10% of these sightings make your skin crawl because they seem to violate all known laws of physics. They seem to zigzag. They seem to travel at high velocities, velocities that perhaps would crush any living person inside them. So what could they possibly be? Well, this object here that was seen in Arizona recently was traveling fairly slowly. Therefore, one possibility is a balloon launched by an amateur. Amateur balloons are not cataloged by the government. And these amateur balloons are getting better and better. Many people put cameras on them, hook them up to their cell phone, and they get a picture of the surface of the Earth from many miles up. So that's one possibility that cannot be dismissed easily, and that is an amateur balloon. Maybe an amateur balloon that is so high up there that the owner lost track of it and didn't even know that his balloon was sending off alarm bells. That's one possibility. Another possibility is, well, it is Arizona near New Mexico where we have Roswell, and we do know that the military tests advanced aircrafts at Area 51, and it means that the next generation of things that are being tested are hypersonic drones. It turns out that hypersonic drones are much faster than supersonic jets. They can outrace them, and because they are drones, they can execute all sorts of maneuvers that would crush humans that happen to be inside the UFO. So that is a possibility. The possibility is that it's, again, secret military aircraft. In fact, the military has admitted that it deliberately fosters some of these UFO stories in order to deflect from the stealth bomber program. The stealth bomber program was developed in total secrecy, and in doing so, they had to make sure that journalists didn't get wind of the fact that they were experimenting with a stealth bomber. And that's why the military would deliberately feed the media stories about flying saucers in order to deflect from its experimental program. So what is the Pentagon working on now? Some people suspect they are hypersonic drones. First of all, they're drones, so they can withstand all sorts of pressures and gyrations that would normally crush a normal person. Well, then the next obvious question is, what do we do if one day we actually make contact with an advanced civilization in outer space? Well, I tend to agree with my late colleague, Dr. Stephen Hawking, who said that we should not advertise our existence to alien civilizations because we don't know what their intentions are. After all, look what happened when Montezuma met Cortez. The Aztecs thought that Cortez and his bloodthirsty cutthroats were gods. Big mistake. Within just a few months, the entire Aztec civilization was crushed because the Spaniards had steel, they had gunpowder, they had horses, while the Aztecs did not even have a written language. And so I think that it's not a good idea for us to try to deliberately send signals in outer space to engage in a conversation with an alien civilization. If we do pick up emissions from an advanced civilization, I think instead of sending a message back, we should simply listen. Listen in on their emissions to find out how advanced they are. and then to find out what their intentions might be. Then let's say the aliens decide to come visit us. What do we do then? Then, of course, it's already too late to just try to observe them. They're already here. What are we going to do? Well, some people think that protocols have already been written, that the nations of the world are going to have an emergency meeting of the United Nations, and we're all going to get together and peacefully work out the details. Wrong. I've had people from the City Project on exploration, and they tell me that there are no protocols. There's nothing we've done so far to prepare civilizations to meet aliens from outer space. Zip, zero, nada. And the reason why is the giggle factor. The nations of the world simply giggle whenever someone mentions the possibility of an alien civilization. So basically, it's going to be a free-for-all. So when we detect messages from an alien civilization, there could very well be panic. Panic in the general public, because people are not prepared for this kind of news. And then the next question is, well, if they do come visit us, what do they want? Well, we think that when they come visit us, they're going to give us the benefits of their technology. They're going to give us an age of Aquarius, the benefits of all their wondrous technology given to us because we're such nice people. Well, I tend to have my doubts. Because, of course, look at what happened in the past. When humans interact with animals in the forest, we don't necessarily have their interests in mind. For example, if you were to walk down a country road and meet forest creatures, are you going to go down there and talk to the squirrels and the deer and try to engage in a conversation with them? No. You get bored very quickly because they don't talk back to you and they have nothing to offer you. And so as a consequence, you either leave them alone or perhaps pave them over and create a housing development right on their property. So, in other words, we don't have anything that we can offer them. Now, you may say to yourself, well, in the movies, maybe they want to plunder our gold, plunder our minerals. Well, first of all, gold may mean nothing to them. Gold is not a very practical element. And also, think of the fact that there are a lot of uninhabited planets out there that they can plunder without having to bother with the rest of natives on the planet Earth. So, in other words, I think for the most part, they're going to leave us alone because we're not interesting to them. We have nothing to offer them because our technology is so primitive compared to their technology. Now, there's some attitudes that they can take which have been explored by science fiction writers. One is that perhaps they'll observe us as zoo animals and create a game park, a game preserve. And so that means that we're off limits to anyone who wants to plunder our civilization. Well, that's possible. But personally, I think the following. Personally, I think that if they're that advanced, they've had hundreds, thousands of years in which to work out sectarian, religious, racial differences. And as a consequence, they reach a certain level of enlightenment. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to give us the benefit of their technology. No. I think for the most part, they'll probably just leave us alone. Leave us alone because we have nothing to offer them. Leave us alone because if they were to make contact with us, they would seriously disturb the status quo on the planet Earth. I mean, think about it for a moment. If an advanced civilization were to land on the Earth and there's no protocols, there's no United Nations action, then what's going to happen? What's going to happen is that different nations of the world will try to butter up to the aliens and try to earn their favor in order to squash their enemies. In other words, they try to use alien technology to learn about their weapons and their science in order to crush their rivals. This is, of course, not in the interest of humanity, but, you know, human nature being the way it is, that's most likely what's going to happen. And so I think that, again, for the most part, I think the aliens will leave us alone because we really have not much to offer. But I think the most important thing is we have to figure out what their level of technology is. We physicists rank them according to energy consumption in terms of type 1, type 2, and 3 technologies. A type 1 civilization harnesses the power of an entire planet. They are about 100 years more advanced than us. They've already mastered space travel to a limited degree. And they control the weather. They control the atmosphere of their planet. And anything planetary, they control. We are about 100 years from becoming a type 1 civilization ourselves. In a few thousand years, they'll be type 2. They'll control the output of a star, like the Federation of Planets on Star Trek. Now, a type 2 civilization is very interesting because they are immortal. Nothing known to science can destroy a type 2 civilization. Meteors and comets can be deflected. Ice ages can be diverted because, of course, they control the weather. Volcanoes, supervolcanoes, all sorts of natural disasters they control because they control the weather. Even if their sun were to explode in a supernova, they would simply leave their planet because they possess the technology to go to the nearby stars. So we scientists have looked for type 2 civilizations. Unfortunately, we have found none. And there's some debate among scientists as to why. Why haven't we picked up emissions from a type 2 civilization, which would be quite noticeable? And then, of course, there's type 3. Type 3 is galactic. They roam the galactic space lanes. And they have the ability, perhaps, to even tinker with the fabric of space and time. The Planck energy is the energy at which you have deformities, rips, tears in the fabric of space and time. And you can calculate that a type 3 civilization would be able to harness the power of a black hole and harness the power of the Planck energy. So in other words, maybe they have warp drive, maybe even a form of time travel. They control the fabric of space-time itself. And on that scale, you can see that, well, we're rather insignificant. We get our energy from oil and coal, dead plants. They probably have gigantic fusion machines. They've already mastered the technology of manipulating stars and black holes. At that point, you can see that we really have not much to offer them. But we are so arrogant to believe that the aliens are going to travel hundreds of light years just to visit us, just to give us the benefits of their advanced technology. No, I don't think so. I think Hollywood movies got it all wrong. We're simply not that important. Well, that's it for the first part of Exploration. In the second part, we're going to bring on an astronomer, Ken Croswell, to talk about all the recent developments. And once again, thank you so much for supporting my work and attending my book tour. My book, The Future of Humanity, is now a New York Times bestseller, thanks to you. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Once again, for a copy of today's program, call 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. So stay tuned as we explore outer space. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we talked about TESS, a new satellite that'll explore extrasolar planets in outer space. We talked about UFOs. We talked about potentially one day meeting intelligent life in the universe. So in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on, once again, Dr. Ken Croswell, astronomer of Berkeley, author of a number of great books about astronomy, including Alchemy of the Heavens, Magnificent Mars, and many others. And so we'll be talking about Mars. We'll be talking about the solar system and what lurks outside the solar system when we explore extrasolar planets. And once again, I'd like to thank those people who attended my book tour. It was because of you that my book, The Future of Humanity, sailed onto the New York Times bestseller list. And the book talks about the future of space exploration. You know, it's getting easier and easier to explore outer space. The Indians, the Chinese, they're all jumping into the game. And NASA will no longer be the agency to nowhere. New energy, new excitement is being pumped into the space program because, well, Silicon Valley entrepreneurs are jumping into the game, footing the bill for a lot of this stuff. And prices have dropped to the point where a movie like The Martian, starring Matt Damon, costing $100 million, actually costs more money than the Indian mission to Mars, which only cost $70 million. And so, believe it or not, a Hollywood movie about going to Mars costs more than actually going to Mars. That's how cheap things are getting. So once again, we have with us today Dr. Ken Croswell, astronomer of Berkeley, author of a number of great books about astronomy, talking about Mars, the solar system, and what lies beyond. Well, with us today is Dr. Ken Croswell, astronomer at Berkeley, author of a number of great books, Magnificent Mars, Magnificent Universe, The Universe at Midnight, you name it, he's written about it. And let's start, first of all, with our own backyard, and that is the planet Mars. We've been hearing a lot about the planet Mars in terms of our rovers, which seem to have confirmed the existence of water flows on the red planet, perhaps billions of years ago. But first of all, what would it like to actually be on the planet Mars?
Well, hello, Michiel. Glad to join you. And yes, Mars is our second nearest planetary neighbor. Venus actually comes closer to us than Earth than Mars does. But modern Mars is a very hostile planet. Nevertheless, it's the best of all the planets that we know of in our solar system in terms of having Earth-like conditions. But if you were to visit Mars, you would definitely need a spacesuit because the atmosphere is incredibly thin. It's less than 1% the air pressure here on Earth, so it's very little air to breathe. And furthermore, most of the atmosphere of Mars is carbon dioxide, the same gas that we get rid of when we breathe. So there's essentially no oxygen in the air to breathe on Mars. And as you might imagine, because Mars is farther from the sun than we are, it's very cold on Mars. It's a very cold, very dry place. There's no running water that we're aware of. And it's I would describe it as a super Antarctica. Raised to a very high altitude with incredibly thin air. And by the way, there's also no ozone layer on Mars, so there's nothing to protect you from the deadly ultraviolet radiation from the sun. So if that sounds like the sort of place you'd like to visit, well, go right ahead. But I think I'm going to stay here, right here on Earth.
Okay, now some people who believe that we should colonize Mars cheaply say that the pioneers were able to colonize the U.S. of A. by living off the land. They didn't bring water, they didn't bring supplies with them as they went across the Midwest out to California. They essentially, hunted and scavenged what they could. Now, on Mars, can you really live off the land? I mean, can you raise crops there? Are there animals to hunt? What is it like to try to, quote, live off the land on Mars?
Well, there certainly aren't any animals or plants on Mars. But people have suggested this idea that it would be a lot cheaper, a lot easier if we can simply send people to Earth and they will basically construct what they need out of what they find on Mars. I have no doubt that crops could grow in Martian soil if subjected to the right conditions. We know that the crops might even be healthier. We know that the Martian surface has a lot of iron, and that's what colors the planet. It's a vivid orange color. So the plants there actually might be healthier than the ones we grow here on Earth. But having said that, of course, there are huge challenges. The the settlers to America didn't have to worry about finding water or finding air to breathe. Now, there is ice beneath the surface of Mars. We know that. And so you could melt that ice and have water, but you're still going to have a problem with having enough oxygen to breathe. So I think it would be quite a challenge, and yet some people have suggested this, because if you have to bring everything that you need from Earth, it takes an enormous amount of energy to lift anything off of Earth and escape the Earth's gravitational pull. So you understand the concept here is that just to make it cheaper and easier to get away from Earth, the less you take with you, the easier it is to travel. I mean, same principle as applies when you're flying. The less luggage you take with you, the easier it is. But of course, when you get to where you're going, you don't have as much stuff. And in the case of Mars, I think it would be a real challenge to do that. But there are some people who are suggesting that they could do it. And, it's an interesting concept. That's all I will say.
Well, let me run this by you. Some Mars enthusiasts have said that we should give one-way tickets to the Red Planet. You would land on the Red Planet, and then a second unmanned rocket comes later, and it contains some rocket fuel. And plus, even on the surface of Mars, you could melt some of the ice, because Mars is a frozen desert. Take that water from the ice, take out the oxygen and hydrogen from the water, and then use that for rocket fuel for a return trip back. So here's the question. Would you want to go to Mars knowing that it's a one-way ticket and that you have to scavenge rocket fuel for the return voyage?
Well, personally, I would not, because I like it a lot here on Earth. But there are many people who would take you up on that offer. So I don't think there will be any problem finding people who want to do this. The real question is, will they survive or not? And I don't know. I mean, I don't think anyone knows. I'm not a rocket engineer. I'm an astronomer. So it's something that might happen later in the 21st century, though.
Okay. Now, some people who have analyzed the data from our Mars rovers roving on the surface of Mars, they find no evidence of liquid water, but there is tantalizing evidence that water once flowed freely on the surface of Mars, perhaps billions of years ago, and there could, in fact, be organic materials, maybe even evidence of life. So what are your thoughts about whether or not billions of years in the past, Mars may have been, in fact, tropical, and perhaps microbial life may have survived then? What are your thoughts?
Well, definitely billions of years ago, Mars was a better planet than it is today. I doubt it was ever tropical, but we know that that water did flow on Mars. We see in the oldest parts of Mars, dried up riverbeds. We also see flood channels on Mars. So we know that water did flow on Mars many, many billions of years ago. The big question has been just how much milder was Mars many billions of years ago. There have been some people who have suggested that it may have been, tropical or at least warmer. I very much doubt that. I think what you're seeing in those riverbeds is rivers that probably only flowed occasionally when it got sufficiently warm to allow water to flow. In fact, there's a river in Antarctica that it only flows a few days every year. And it's entirely possible that ancient Mars may have been similar, that it was a very hostile place, very cold place, and only on rare occasions did it get warm enough to allow water to flow. But once you have liquid water, water in liquid form, then it's possible that some form of life could have developed. There's recently been a proposal, in fact, that maybe punctuated volcanism occurred on Mars. We know that volcanoes erupt lots of greenhouse gases, and according to this new theory, maybe when you had a lot of volcanic eruptions on Mars, it warmed Mars for a few centuries, and during that time, rivers could flow, and maybe, who knows, maybe some form of life could have developed on Mars.
Now, recently, there was a flash in the news stating that perhaps methane gas has been detected on Mars, and where there's methane, perhaps there are decaying organic materials, or perhaps it's a normal naturally occurring chemical process. But what are your thoughts about the possibility that there could be methane gas on Mars, indicating perhaps the presence of microbial life?
Well, I'm very skeptical that there's any life on Mars today. Even microbial life, I just don't think Mars is just such a very hostile place. So I think that methane gas, the very small amount of methane gas that has been found, probably has a non-biological explanation. So the methane alone does not convince me that there is some form of microbial life on the planet.
Okay, well, here's a wild theory. One theory says that Mars basically cooled off before the Earth. Earth was still molten while Mars was cooling off. Perhaps DNA got off the ground on Mars first as a consequence. Then perhaps meteors slammed into Mars during that period of time. And DNA, like a ping pong ball, began to go into outer space and seed the Earth. And then when these meteors containing DNA hit the Earth, it seeded the Earth, and that's where we come from. So if you want to see a Martian tonight, look in a mirror. What are your thoughts about that wild theory?
Well, it's a possibility. Certainly because Mars was a better planet 4 billion years ago, it's possible that some form of life developed there. We know that since Mars is a smaller planet, a less massive planet, it's much easier to launch material into space from Mars than it is from Earth. And therefore, if an asteroid slams into Mars, you're going to get a bunch of rocks kicked up. Some of those rocks will make their way to Earth. And indeed, we have found a number of meteorites from Mars. And so it's conceivable that, if DNA formed on Mars, if some form of life formed on Mars, some of that life could have hitched a ride on one of these meteorites and made it to Earth and seeded the Earth. So it's possible. On the other hand, it's also possible that life on Earth arose right here on Earth, and we didn't really need any help from the planet Mars. I don't see an easy way to test the idea, though, as to whether life on Earth arose on Earth or arose first on Mars or maybe even someplace else.
Okay, well, the president has said that perhaps by 2030 or so, there could be humans on the red planet. And then the question is, well, what do they do on the red planet? One possibility is to terraform it, that is, create a Garden of Eden on Mars by initiating a greenhouse effect. However, don't you think that that would be centuries away? It's not going to be easy to planetary reform the environment, right? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think you are talking about something that's not going to happen in the 21st century in terms of terraforming, because Mars is just, it's going to take a lot to terraform Mars, to bring it up to a warm temperature. It's on average 52% farther from the sun than the Earth is, and so it needs a much larger greenhouse effect than we have here on Earth. The Earth has a greenhouse effect that raises our temperature about 60 degrees Fahrenheit. In other words, if we didn't have greenhouse gases such as water vapor and carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, the mean temperature of the Earth would be about 0 degrees Fahrenheit versus what it actually is, which is 60 degrees Fahrenheit. To raise the temperature on Mars, which is even colder, is going to take an even more substantial greenhouse effect. Now, there is a small greenhouse effect already on Mars. 95% of the atmosphere is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, and the greenhouse effect there raises the temperature about 10 degrees Fahrenheit, but that's just not nearly enough to make Mars a pleasant place to live. So, yes, if terraforming of Mars ever happens, we're talking much, much farther into the future. I think one of the big jobs of any astronaut going to Mars ought to be to look for fossils of ancient life on Mars, because that's something that, as we've been discussing, we really don't know what went on Mars 4 billion years ago, but we do know that it was a better planet back then. And so if life could have formed on Mars, it surely would have done so long ago. So if astronauts can seek out fossils of that ancient life, that would be a major discovery. That would tell us that life had established itself on another planet besides Earth.
Now, quite a few years ago, there was a blip in the media stating that scientists have analyzed one of these meteorites that came from Mars. It really was a piece of Martian rock. It had all the right characteristics of Martian rock. And you cracked it open and bingo, there were these little wormy things inside. And they created a tremendous controversy. Some people said, aha, this is evidence of microbial life. Other people said, well, no, it could be crystals, just naturally occurring crystals. But that was several years ago. What's the latest in terms of whether or not scientists believe that we've actually picked up evidence of life forms of Mars on the Earth?
That was in 1996 that claim was made, and it has not fared well in the years since. The people who are experts on this matter, most of them dismiss that claim. Now, what is true and is unquestionable is that we do have rocks from Mars on Earth because, as I mentioned, asteroids every now and then climb into Mars, and it's fairly easy to launch material into space from Mars because its gravity is weaker than the Earth's gravity. So we definitely, so half of that claim is correct. I mean, the rock really is from Mars, but the people who are experts, I would say 98% of them do not believe that there is evidence for life in that meteorite. So that claim has not fared well with time.
Okay, well, moving farther into the solar system, let's now talk about meteors and comets. Recently, there was the Rosetta probe, which gave us rather sensational up-close photographs of a comet, and there was actually a close encounter, and they were able to actually land a probe on the comet. So here's an easy question. What is the difference between a meteor, a comet, and a meteorite?
Well, a comet is an object, a fairly large object that goes around the sun that contains rock and water ice. And when one of these objects comes close to the sun, the ice vaporizes, and we see a spectacular tail to the comet. A comet is something that it doesn't just flash across the sky in a second or two. You can see it night after night after night. And in fact, I'm sure many of your listeners saw Comet Hale-Bopp back in 1997 for many, many evenings. That was an absolutely spectacular comet. Now, in contrast, a meteor is simply an object that flashes across the sky, a flash of light that maybe lasts a few seconds. And there is a relationship between comets and meteors because as comets travel through space, they lose dust. And when those dust particles, which are called meteoroids, smash into the Earth's atmosphere, they burn up and we see this spectacular flash of light called a meteor. And then a meteorite is a rock that actually makes it to the Earth's surface. Most of the stuff, which is good news for us, most of it burns up in the Earth's atmosphere, so we don't get hit by it. But every now and then, one of these rocks makes it to Earth, and once it lands on Earth, it's called a meteorite. So we have most meteorites come from asteroids, but some come from Mars, and others come from the Moon. So those are the three answers to your question. Comets, meteors, and meteorites. Meteors come from comets, and meteorites are those few objects that actually make it through the Earth's atmosphere and land on Earth.
Okay. Now, also, people ask the question, well, why should I care? However, these objects are potentially dangerous, right? What happened over Russia, over Chelyabinsk, Russia, a few years ago, and for that matter, what happened 65 million years ago to the dinosaurs who are not here to talk about it?
That's right. These objects are potentially dangerous. And so what we'd like to do is to find all the objects out there that might impact the Earth and then see if we need to devise some strategy to deal with them. On the other hand, these objects also very likely brought benefits. The water that is now on Earth likely came from asteroids and comets impacting the Earth shortly after its birth. And in fact, this is probably the first real scientific result to come from the Rosetta mission to that comet, in that the scientists have analyzed the data, and they conclude that most of the water on Earth came not from comets, but instead from asteroids. So that is another reason we should care, not just that these objects can hit us, but also because without asteroids and without comets, we might not have the water that we need to make life possible here on Earth.
Okay, let's go over that point again, because that's pretty significant. On the planet Earth, roughly 3/4 of the surface of the planet is liquid water. However, liquid water is quite precious in the solar system, but where did all this water come from, given the fact we don't see too much water out there except in the form of ice? So you're saying that the water on the Earth probably came from asteroids, not comets. So when you drink water, you're actually drinking asteroid water.
Basically, yes, yes. Here's the reason the existence of water, which we kind of take for granted, is a mystery on Earth. The Earth formed just 93 million miles from the sun. That's pretty close. And we know that the Earth and the other planets formed from a disk of gas and dust that went around the young sun. And that disk was quite hot, close to the sun. So the Earth formed in a fairly hot part of that protoplanetary disk. And so you don't really expect it to have incorporated much water. The water should have all vaporized. There really should not be much water on Earth at all. And yet, as you point out, most of the Earth's surface is covered by water. So the question is, where did it come from? And for a long time, there was a nice theory that comets delivered Earth its water, because comets fly in the outer part of our solar system. They're nice and cold, and they contain water ice. And every now and then, one of those hits the Earth and gave us our water. Well, if that were really true, then you would expect the composition of comet water to be the same as the composition of Earth water. And in particular, the comet should have the same deuterium to hydrogen ratio as Earth water does. Now, let me define deuterium. Deuterium is simply an isotope of hydrogen. Normal hydrogen has one proton in its nucleus and no neutron, whereas deuterium has one proton and also one neutron, so it's twice as heavy as a normal hydrogen atom. And just as water, you know, most water is H2O, but you can also have HDO or even D2O, in which deuterium takes the place of hydrogen. And if comets in fact supplied Earth with its water, then the deuterium to hydrogen ratio should be the same in comets as in Earth's water. And when the very first such measurement was ever made, back in 1980, when the most famous comet, Halley's Comet, passed by Earth, well, guess what? The deuterium to hydrogen ratio, it was twice what is in Earth water. And so that was a blow to the theory. But it wasn't fatal because, hey, Halley's Comet is just one comet, right? Well, in the 1990s, two more bright comets came by, Comet Hyakutake in 1996 and Comet Hale-Bopp in 1997. And they also had twice the deuterium to hydrogen ratio as Earth water. So at this point, the water theory as coming from comets was in serious trouble. And with one exception, all the other comets that have been examined since have had higher deuterium to hydrogen ratios than Earth's water. And this the most recent data comes from the Rosetta spacecraft. And now the scientists are reporting that the comet that the Rosetta spacecraft visited has the highest deuterium to hydrogen ratio ever measured in a comet, more than three times the terrestrial level. And so this leads the scientists to conclude, just as you say, that most of Earth's water probably came from asteroids that hit the Earth rather than comets, because we do know that asteroids have deuterium to hydrogen ratios that are very similar to that in Earth's water. So it may be very romantic to think of comets as, you know, these beautiful comets are supplying us our water, but the latest evidence suggests that it's actually these rather dull-looking asteroids that supplied most of the water on Earth.
And also the Rosetta probe made history because it was able to put a probe on the surface of a comet. Wasn't that remarkable that we're rather sophisticated now in our celestial mechanics and navigation that we can actually make a soft landing on a comet?
Yes, yes, it definitely is a major achievement. And it's a first, and hopefully there will be more. Hopefully we can have more close-up views of comets in the future.
Now, recently, a few years ago, there was a press release issued by Google and Yahoo and Microsoft billionaires. These billionaires, as I recall, said that the next frontier is the asteroids and we should mine them. There's money to be made, they said. And, of course, the question is, well, whose money is going to pay for it? These asteroids are very far away. But what are your thoughts? What are your thoughts about, quote, mining the sky? That is, at one point in the future, sending space probes that would then mine platinum-type alloys and materials on the asteroids.
Well, my very first thought is it's incredibly expensive to do something like that. And so what you mine, if you're really going to try to make money in this way, it seems to me what you mine is going to have to be incredibly valuable. So I'm not an economist. I don't know if the numbers work out, but it just my instinct, everything I know about space is that it's expensive. I mean, for example, whenever we astronomers launch a telescope in space, such as the Hubble Space Telescope, it costs a lot of money, a lot more money than just building a telescope here on Earth. And so mining an asteroid is going to be a lot more expensive than mining minerals here on the Earth. And so I don't know. It seems to me you would have to have some pretty precious stuff on that asteroid in order to make it pay.
Yes, it cost about $1 billion to build the Hubble Space Telescope. And then when it was launched, it came out nearsighted. The optics were wrong. And they had to have a second $1 billion mission to put corrective lenses on the Hubble Space Telescope. Now,
yes,
also,
indeed.
What are your thoughts about the Sentinel program? That is, some scientists have advocated that we have an early warning system, that is, a series of telescopes in space that would identify near-Earth objects, that is, potential candidates for killer asteroids and killer meteors that might hit the Earth. So what are your thoughts about an early detection system that could give us maybe an insurance policy of some sort if something is coming our way?
Well, I think it's a good idea because that's something that would not cost so much money. We're not talking billions of dollars there. I mean, simply to discover all things out there that cross the Earth's orbit, you're probably talking a few million dollars to do that. And I think that's an excellent investment and an excellent idea.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for our interview, part one, with Ken Croswell, astronomer of Berkeley. We'll run part two on another day. And let me say that if you want to know more about the space program, the fact that we are entering a new second golden era of space travel, with costs dropping dramatically, new types of rockets, new innovation, and money from Silicon Valley billionaires. If you want to know more about this new excitement, get a copy of my latest book, The Future of Humanity. And because of you, the book is now a New York Times bestseller. Thank you so much for supporting my book tour. Thank you so much, and perhaps I autographed your copy of The Future of Humanity. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230.